You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
You're listening to continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Court is now in session. Honorable Matthew Hoffman presiding. As always, there'll be no talking while His Honor is on the bench. Now you may be seated.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. I understand there's a matter to take up outside the presence of the jury.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Jeffrey Bright, Your Honor. For the record, Your Honor, we advised the court and the court urged us at the beginning of this trial to make sure that it set, we had agreement with counsel and urging of the court at 7 o'clock each evening, we would provide the witness list for the next day. Defendants in this case have subpoenaed 42 witnesses, and they have asked virtually every one of our fact witnesses to be reserved for trial. Last night at 7 o'clock, we advised the court early and counsel that we would be finished either Wednesday afternoon or Thursday morning. No surprise. The defendants last night gave us one witness for today, and that's a witness who's already testified, Officer Blythe. I know that they have their own strategy to keep, but they've now told us their experts are unavailable till Monday. There are at least 35 local witnesses here in Newport News that are under subpoena. And I'm just wondering, like, what's happening with one witness when we're trying to do an efficient trial? I would have thought their experts would have been here no later than tomorrow at worst. Now they've given us one witness and reserving 41 witnesses. So I think the court needs to understand that, what are we gonna just go home and do nothing until Monday, or are they gonna wait and hold 20 witnesses tomorrow? So I'm of great concern that we are wasting huge amount of judicial time as well as counsel time. And that is my concern. Officer Blythe, we have other issues with, but we'll bring it up after they start their case.
All right. All right, were you not able to provide a schedule for witnesses?
We did provide. I'm going to let Mr. Hogan address the issues about the fact witnesses. I want to address the scheduling. We asked months ago when we would get the case. We've been told repeatedly midday on Friday, and we planned accordingly. I made the court aware very early on that our experts were coming on Monday. So that there's nothing new here. They significantly truncated their case, and we have not heard the testimony of the day, which largely depends on will change what fact witnesses that we call. So I'm going to let Mr. Hogan address that.
All right. Mr. Honor, may it please the court. With respect to the fact witnesses, I'll note Mr. Bright is correct that there are several witnesses on deck. They may be necessary to rebut or challenge the testimony that develops today. Also, as Ms. Douglas has alluded to, this case has been fluid from the beginning, although we have been received assurances throughout that it was likely that we would receive the case by Friday. To the extent that there's an inconvenience to these witnesses, I've been in close coordination with them. I've kept them apprised of the proceedings throughout, and so depending on how the evidence shakes out today, I can also confer with counsel at the end of today, and we can make a decision and give them notice about who to expect tomorrow. If I'm not trying to keep anybody on the hook and keep them in limbo without, I'm not trying to unduly inconvenience people. I'm sensitive to that fact, Judge. But these folks, we can't control the way the evidence develops or some of the calendaring issues. So.
All right, yeah, I've understood about the experts. I'm assuming they're coming from other places other than here, and that those travel arrangements had to be made ahead of time, and that was your best guess for Monday. And you've told the court that when we started that. So I don't have any problem with that. I'm just hoping that we can get in as many fact witnesses on the defense side on Friday, and I understand the need to wait to hear what the testimony is today to then decide, but I am going to ask that, by the end of court today, I'll give you some time after we're finished with the witnesses, that we talk about another scheduling time for and how many witnesses you think you can call either this afternoon or for Friday. All right, so I'll withhold any decision on that or taking any action, I will say. Okay. All right. Are you ready to call your next witness and have the jury come in?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Very well. All right. You may bring in the jury.
Wait, Paul.
All right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. All right. We are going to proceed with the plaintiff's next witness.
Dr. Clarence Watson.
Let me get you stand here. Face the clerk. Raise your right hand.
Do you swear that the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so evident?
Yes.
This way. Watch your step, step and up.
May it please the court?
You may proceed.
Good morning, Dr. Watson.
Good morning.
Could you go ahead and introduce yourself to the jury and state your full name for the court reporter?
Yes, my name is Dr. Clarence Watson. Clarence Watson.
And you're a doctor. You're a doctor in what?
Psychiatry, forensic psychiatry.
And doctor, you're here today because at some point we had asked you to evaluate our client, Miss Abigail Zwerner. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you, as a result of that evaluation, have come to some findings as it relates to her psychiatric condition. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And we'll get to that during your testimony. But we have to sort of check some boxes before we can get there. We can go to the IPVO. And so this is a little roadmap of what we'll be talking about today. Okay?
Okay.
We're going to talk about you to start. We'll talk about your experiences. Then we'll talk about the evaluation itself of Ms. Zwerner. Then I want to talk to you about this brain-body concept that may come out in that evaluation.
Yes.
And then I want to talk to you about your view and your prognosis for Ms. Zwerner's future. Sound good?
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about your experience. You said you're a doctor in psychiatry. Can you walk us through your educational background that led to that DR in front of your name?
Sure. So I started on a different path. I started out my undergrad degree at Temple University in Philadelphia, where I earned an economics degree. At the time, I was deciding between medicine and the law, and I decided that law was quicker.
My condolences.
So I went to law school. Yeah. After undergrad, I graduated from Villanova School of Law. And then I decided that I was not done with this sort of science bug and the medical, my interest in medicine. And so I went into a post-bac program to take prerequisite courses to allow me to apply to medical school and successfully completed that. And then went on to Jefferson Medical College, where I graduated from medical school. After that, I went into internal medicine at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, did my internship there, and then thereafter switched to general psychiatry and completed my residency in psychiatry at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. Following that four-year period, I then went into forensic psychiatry training in New York, at St. Vincent's Hospital, the New York Medical College.
And could you talk to us about the distinction or the difference, if any, between general psychiatry, the 4 years, and then what you do in the 2 years of forensic psychiatry training?
Sure. And the training for forensic psychiatry fellowship program is 1 year. And so it's a total of training in psychiatry for me of 5 years. And the general training is learning everything that you need to know about mental health disorders. And so that spans across all age groups and genders. It expands across all mental health disorders, anxiety disorders, depressive disorders, psychotic disorders, developmental disorders in children and adolescents, geriatric issues and problems as well. And so that training involves treating individuals with these mental health disorders, these populations, providing care for them and follow-up in different settings, sometimes in outpatient settings, sometimes in inpatient settings. And after completing that, I went into forensic psychiatry, and the difference there is that you learn how to apply your general understanding of psychiatric disorders in legal situations where a legal question is posed. So that might be in cases similar to the case today in civil lawsuits. It could also be involved in criminal cases around issues of mental state at the time of the offense and competence to stand trial.
And as part of those two areas of psychiatry, first we're talking general psychiatry and then forensic psychiatry, is there a board certification process?
Yes.
And are you board certified in general psychiatry?
I am.
And are you board certified in forensic psychiatry?
Yes.
And could you tell us just briefly what it means to be board certified in those fields?
Sure. What that means is that after your training, first you have to have all the requirements to be able to sit for a board examination and that you've completed that successfully, and then you meet all of the standards in which is tested through examination to adequately go treat individuals in the community around mental health disorders. So there's a test you have to pass to be board certified, and there's a stamp of approval that is given to you in those specialties.
And since you received that stamp of approval, have you been applying those both general psychiatric and forensic psychiatric skills and lessons?
Oh yes, every day.
And tell us about your clinical experience from the time of education to present.
Yes, so after my training in New York, I returned to Philadelphia where I worked on the inpatient psychiatric unit at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. I continued my work there also in outpatient treatment for individuals who were not admitted to the hospital, but had mental health disorders and difficulties in the community. After that, I moved on to oversee the forensic psychiatry There's a forensic building program in Delaware, a maximum security forensic unit where individuals with criminal justice involvement are they're admitted there on an inpatient basis. And so I provided clinical care for those individuals, treating those folks who were in the Department of Corrections and destabilized there and needed to be stabilized and returned to prison. Individuals who were found not competent to stand trial and then received treatment to restore their competence, and other individuals who were ordered there by the court because of mental health problems related to their case, making sure that those individuals will be able to be adequately treated and then transferred to prison to set out the rest of their services. As I continued on in terms of my clinical practice, I eventually made my way back to Pennsylvania from Delaware, where I became the statewide forensic director, overseeing the two state forensic hospitals in Pennsylvania. In that capacity, I handle complex psychiatric cases, overseeing the psychiatrists and physicians who treat those individuals. I also become involved in treatment interventions, reviewing those cases for efficacy of treatment, making recommendations, and then overseeing that treatment to be sure that those individuals were actually responding positively to the treatment.
And in that, through that clinical practice, in addition to that, do you have any academic appointments presently?
Yes, I am. I've been appointed clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania.
And can you just briefly tell us what that means in terms of your workload and balancing the other stuff we've talked about?
Sure. So my faculty appointment at the University of Pennsylvania allows me to train psychiatrists or doctors at various points in their training and career. So there might be medical students, it could be psychiatric residents, it also could be fellows, so folks who have completed their psychiatric training and then they move on for subspecialty training like I did in forensics. As a part of my work there, I'm also the director of the Forensic Psychiatry Fellowship Program at Penn. So I train psychiatrists to do the work that I'm doing today.
And doctor, throughout your experience, this is a presumption, but I want you to confirm it, that you've been exposed to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes, regularly.
And you've clinically diagnosed it in other people.
Yes, and treated it, yes.
You've seen how it develops over time, chronic and acute.
Yes.
You've encountered anxiety disorders and depressive disorders.
Yes.
And you've encountered essentially these manifestations that we may be talking about today in Ms. Werner and other people throughout your both clinical, educational, and academic settings.
Yes, that's true.
I now tender Dr. Watson as an expert in the fields of general psychiatry and forensic psychiatry.
Any objection to that?
No objection.
All right, he'll be so qualified.
Dr. Watson, I'm going to ask you about the evaluation now. And as we go through it, I may be asking you for your findings or your opinions as we go through them. Will you agree only to offer those if you hold them within a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
Okay. So, at some point in time, we contacted you in order to perform an evaluation of Ms. Werner, is that right?
That's correct.
Can you walk us through the process that you followed in order to conduct the evaluation and then come to your findings that you're sharing with us today?
Yes. So the evaluation started out with a discussion with your office about the case in general, receiving a summary of the case and learning more about the complaint in the case. At that point, determining whether or not my expertise is something that I would be able to lend to the case in one way or the other after I learned more about the case. Once the decision was made that that would work, then we went about having me receive records related to Ms. Werner's history, the incident that brings us here today, her medical records, Once I received those, then it was a matter of scheduling a meeting with Ms. Werner, we were able to accomplish that. I met her on two occasions, one in person, and that was in my office in Pennsylvania in October, I want to say October 2024, and we met there for about 4 hours. And then I later saw Ms. Werner this summer at some point, I want to say maybe in July of 2025. And that was after receiving additional records that I did not have earlier on for issues that Ms. Werner had in between our evaluation times. After that, I prepared a report and then submitted it to your office.
Now, Dr. Watson, you mentioned previously that you had records that included medical records in her history.
Yes.
And when we say history, we're talking about before January 6, 2023.
That's correct, yes.
And then we're also talking about records since January 6, 2023.
That's correct.
And that included, you know, her primary care doctor and some therapy records as well, correct?
Yes.
And you used those to gather information, and then you sat down with Ms. Werner, as you talked about.
That's correct.
What's the importance or significance of actually sitting down with somebody when you're performing a psychiatric evaluation of them?
Well, it's important to sit down with the individual if you are planning on reaching a diagnosis for that individual. And so reviewing the records alone is not sufficient. Sitting with an individual to evaluate them and ask them about their experiences, their symptoms, and observing their behaviors and their description of those experiences is important objective information. So part of the psychiatric examination is to observe the individual as they are sharing information about their symptoms. The longer that you have with the individual to be able to do that, the better. With that, matching up whether or not what you are seeing in person and what they report to you in person is consistent with what you find in the records. And so that's why it becomes important.
And doctor, when you are going through this evaluation process for Ms. Werner, when you came to your final conclusions and opinions, did you have enough materials and information for you to make that clinical finding?
Yes.
That diagnosis?
Yes.
And can you share with us first what the diagnosis is, and then we'll break that down and explain how and why we got there?
Yes. The diagnosis is post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as a history of a depressive disorder and history of anxiety disorder.
So when you say history, and we sort of called on that word a little bit before, is part of your evaluation to try and determine whether somebody has had any experience in their life before the, what we'll call, incident event?
Yes.
And why is that important?
Well, whenever conducting any psychiatric examination, you have to have a life course to understand where the person is today. And so to simply start off with where they are today is not sufficient. You have to start off way back to see what the source of the person's symptoms happens to be today. So the examination really begins with birth. The evaluation goes back, gathering all sorts of information about developmental history, whether or not there have been traumatic experiences in that person's life up to that point, whether or not that person has a family history that makes them more prone because of genetic predisposition for certain mental health disorders, whether or not that individual has other factors that may be influencing their behaviors and the symptoms. For example, is that person using substances and addiction? Are those addiction actually more likely to be responsible for a person's symptoms than something that they're reporting? Has this person been abused in the past? How long did that abuse go? And so really diving into all of the things that might impact a person's today presentation becomes important. So looking at these historical factors gives us more ability to put into context what we see today.
And in your evaluation of Mrs. Werner's history, were there any findings or observations that became relevant to your ultimate conclusions?
Yes.
Can you explain what those were?
Sure. Well, so I will start with, if I'm thinking about first I will start with the very early positive factors in Ms. Werner's life. And so she had a very positive upbringing, not very traumatic in terms of her history. When she was surrounded by a very positive family, loving family, supportive to her and her needs and encouraging her in terms of her career and focus. There are no issues around substance use disorders or other problematic childhood developmental disorders. So all of that becomes a very important background. There was nothing in terms of growing up with domestic violence or sexual assaults, sexual abuse, no childhood neglect. So we first start with that backdrop. And then noting when there appeared to be maybe some difficulty, some emotional changes and such. And so the first time in terms of the records that I had available to me was somewhere around 2018 where she started to, I believe it was 2016, when she started to express to her family physician that she was at least experiencing some depressive symptoms. At that time, not anything that raised anything major, but she at that time had a transition in life, and that was she was in college, a freshman, dealing with the stresses of being a college student. At some point, though, later on, 2018, the stress of college started to become a little bit more difficult, and her family physician treated her for depressive symptoms and anxiety symptoms, those symptoms being tied to the stress of her academic activities, and that was clear in the records. What was also clear in the records was that even though she was having those symptoms, she was able to continue to function and was functioning relatively well. She was pursuing her degree and completed that successfully. She was social actively. She was actively social, had friends, did things, exercised regularly. And so she was overall doing well, and was being managed well with her family physician in terms of her treatment. Unfortunately, she then had a traumatic experience, one that I think many of us could relate to, which was a loss of her father unexpectedly in 2020. And of course, that was a traumatic experience for her and her family. And there was a period of grief and some difficulty around that grief. And fortunately, she was able to receive some grief counseling to get her through that period of time. She was also able to continue to start her work as a teacher shortly thereafter. As a matter of fact, if I'm remembering correctly, I want to say that her father passed away in, I want to say, July of 2020, I believe, that summer at least, and then she was starting work in that fall, and she was able to do that despite her difficulties around losing her father. And the medical records were very good in documenting her progress during that time, her treatment, and her eventual improvement around the stresses related to that. So those were the major events, including the stress of being a brand new teacher and starting career after college, those sort of things, until we come to January 6th of 2023. I should note, though, that despite some of the symptoms related to her depression and anxiety leading up to that point, and it was very clear in the medical records that she was doing well and had a lot of improvement leading up to January 6, 2023. The records show that she pretty much had mild, if any, symptoms and was doing well overall.
And in terms of the timeline as you've laid out, the loss of her father, 2020, this event, January of 2023, is it, in your review of the records, did it appear that the grief was under control?
Yes.
And that she was operating and going out and returning to her normal self, if we call it that way?
Well, yes. I mean, even with the grief of her father closer to, you know, his death, she was still involved in social activities. She was still involved in family activities. She was still very active, was not withdrawn, not isolative. She was not overwhelmed to the point where she was impaired in her normal functioning at that point.
So I want to transition now and talk about how, if at all, in your findings that changed as a result of January 6, 2023. So we mentioned the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
And if we can just briefly explain to the jury so that it may help us frame it for them. The post-traumatic stress disorder is a condition that's explained in the DSM-5, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Could you tell us briefly what the DSM-5 is, what that means?
Sure. So the DSM-5 stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's the fifth edition now, and there's a later, you know, text revision really refining the definitions around specific mental health disorders. And it is the primary text that mental health clinicians use to reach diagnoses so that we are all understanding the same language when we meet a patient and we diagnose that patient. It guides our treatment approaches to make sure that we're able to select the proper treatment for the individual given the collection of symptoms that they're exhibiting at the time. And so the DSM for short is really our guide to diagnosing and treating patients with mental health disorders.
And what I have on the screen for us to look at is different letters. So we have post-traumatic stress disorder, A, B, C, D, E, and F. Are you able to see that?
Yes.
And I've given them little subheadings. Are these subheadings sort of part, I know they're simplifications, but are they simplifications of what that guide tells you as a clinician in the field of psychiatry to look for if and when diagnosing post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes, although there's one missing, and we can talk about that.
Go ahead and let's put it on there before I forget about it. What is that one?
All right, so let's see. We can put it between C and D, avoidance. So we can call it whatever, C and a half or something you want to call it. So that would be negative alterations in mood and cognition. And then D technically would be what we call alterations in arousal and reactivity.
With those tweaks, is this a simplification of the guide that you walked through in this instance as it relates to Ms. Werner's diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes.
So talk to us about subsection A, traumatic event.
Yes, so the DSM, the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, requires that there is exposure, a person is exposed to actual or threatened death, serious injury, or sexual violence.
And in your evaluation of Ms. Werner, obviously we've talked about the facts of this case, but was there any reporting from her to you about her perceived risk of death?
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, she believed that she was dying, that someone was trying to kill her, and that they had successfully made that attempt, and she was attempting to survive, and she was bleeding and had difficulty breathing and panicking, believing that that individual was following her and was going to finish the job.
And in your review of her evaluation, does that check the box, so to speak, as it relates to the traumatic event?
Absolutely. It's almost, I mean, that's sort of a classic trauma.
So let's talk then about the re-experiencing or re-experienced. Tell us what that means in your world.
Sure. So what that means is that a person is what we call in DSM intrusive symptoms. So either there are distressing memories, distressing nightmares, distressing re-experiencing of events that related to the trauma that are intrusive. In other words, you're not actively thinking about the trauma, but it inserts itself. It pushes itself into your consciousness, even when you don't want it to, right? And so this is when you hear folks say, you know, they've suffered flashbacks, for example, or they say that they had nightmares about the event or something similar to the event, right, in which they are in danger, or and sometimes it is very specific and a reminder very clearly of imagery around the trauma itself. Sometimes it's not that. There are times where a person is in a nightmare where they are fearing their death and or being attacked, and they're running and they're trying to escape something, and maybe it's not as clear. But the clear piece about this is that those nightmares happen, or those intrusive events happen after the trauma. You don't expect to see those sort of things before. And so you look and say, okay, after the trauma, this person is suddenly having these distressing nightmares in which they're in danger. And they're related and associated with the traumatic event itself.
And in your evaluation of Ms. Werner, did she report having nightmares?
Yes, she did.
And you talked about some of these nightmares being specific and some of them being more general.
Yes.
How would you categorize Mrs. Werner's reports of her own nightmare?
Her reports were more specific, yes. So she had some dreams that were related to being, you know, feeling like she was not safe. But generally, she had dreams about the student who shot her. She had dreams about the student's expression, facial expression, as a blank stare as he pulled the trigger. She had dreams about being in the school and the student being there. No one else is in the school, and the student following her, and she tries to escape, and then he finds her in a closet somewhere while she was hiding. She had another nightmare about another student who somehow, I think, was involved in one way or the other, but that student was harmed, and so this gruesome sort of imagery in which that student was found dead. And so her sleep had been disturbed by the pressing of the psychological distress that she's under, thinking about this trauma or dealing with this trauma, that it pushes into even her dreams, and this is how we understand those nightmares.
And you mentioned earlier that your more recent discussion and sit down with Ms. Werner was in July of this year.
Yes.
And in July of this year, did she report whether those nightmares were still occurring?
Yes. I want to say that I think she said something along the lines of, over the previous few months, she had at least three of those nightmares.
And when we talk about having intrusive symptoms and these coming to her in the night, and you mentioned intrusive is, you know, even when you don't want them to.
Right. When something's not, your attention's not necessarily distracted, You know, you could be driving down the road and then this comes to you. And you're re-experiencing or memory, having a memory of this traumatic event. And usually with that comes a physiologic response, right? A person starts to feel some degree of heightened anxiety, heart might be racing. In Ms. Werner's case, she felt shallow breathing, body heaviness, and racing, you know, heart racing palpitations. These are the sort of things that you would expect.
And we talked earlier in your roadmap about the brain and body.
Yes.
Is this physiological response part of what happens when you have a condition like post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes. You know, we tend to have this artificial division between the brain and the body. It's all connected, right? So all of us are sitting right here. Our brain right now is keeping us alive, right? You're not thinking about your heart beating, but guess what? Your brain is making it happen, right? You're listening to me right now. There are all sorts of things that you might feel. Something that if you have your own traumatic experiences might remind you of something. You might feel a little anxiety and such, right? You viscerally, you can feel it. It's not just thoughts. And so for individuals who are suffering from severe post-traumatic stress disorder, this becomes a real thing that can even be paralyzing for individuals who feels like they have to freeze, they can't move. They're in such fear state, right? So even if rationally they say, I'm not in danger right now, I can continue, the body might respond as if there is a real imminent threat. And then your body goes into a fear response physiologically. It prepares for danger. And so this is where we talk about the shallow breathing, the heart racing, and she might be just sitting watching television and this comes to her.
And that may be, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong, but is that what leads us, and let me start here, re-experiencing that in the guidebook was found?
Intrusive, yes.
Found in your evaluation?
Yes.
And when we talk about how these things can be sometimes even paralyzing, does that relate at all to the next finding as it relates to avoidance?
Yes. So because of the re-experiencing, there are times where you might not be just sitting and not doing anything, and then it comes to you, and these negative memories related to the trauma come to you. But there are situations in which they may be triggered by specific reminders in your environment, and then it takes you to those intrusive thoughts, right? So you're sitting and you have this trigger that is a reminder. Let's just say for Ms. Werner, one of her triggers happens to be seeing individuals with their hands in their pocket, right? What are their hands doing in their pocket? Well, the last time she was in danger, real danger, and her life was threatened, someone held their hands in their pocket for a very long time before she was shot. And so seeing individuals in the community or large crowds or something like this may be triggering to the point that you have a re-experiencing of these earlier traumatic event. And so to avoid that, as we all try to do, avoiding things that make us feel uncomfortable or distress us, then for Ms. Werner, the avoidance symptoms will be, I'm going to avoid those things that will cause me psychological distress. So I'm going to avoid schools. I'm going to avoid watching television shows that have classroom settings. I'm going to avoid looking at news reports of school shootings. I'm going to avoid crowds. I'm going to avoid people who have their hands in their pockets. And so those avoidance behaviors, anything that an individual does, I'm not going to go anywhere near the school where I was once upon a time shot, right? All of those things would meet that criterion for avoidance.
And so in your evaluation, Dr. Watson, did Ms. Werner meet that criterion of avoidance?
Definitely, yes.
Now, C2, one I forgot. Negative alterations in mood and cognition. Tell us what that means and how you observed that appearing in Ms. Swerner.
Yes, and these two, the negative alteration in mood and cognition, and increased arousal, the alterations in arousal and reactivity, they are very important, especially in Ms. Swerner's case, when we talk about her history. So apart from those first two criteria in the DSM, they are very clearly connected to the and associated with the traumatic event itself.
And when we say first two, you're talking
right.
re-experience.
B and C, yes, exactly. So those experiences occur after the event. The negative alterations in mood and cognition and increased arousal, the alterations in arousal and reactivity, recognizes the criteria for DSM, recognizes that a person might have already had issues with depression or anxiety earlier on. And so the wording of it within the DSM goes something like, the person now has increased or negative alterations in mood, like depression or anxiety or negative thinking, that begins or worsens after the event. So you don't need to be clean before you reach this particular diagnosis. When I say clean, I mean no history of mood problems. It means that those symptoms actually worsen, if you had them, after the fact. And that would include depression, that would include anxiety symptoms, that would also include ideas and thoughts about oneself and their self-worth, their self-esteem, a sense of control or losing control in one's life. All of those things would be fall into C2.
And so when we're talking about C2 and D, if I were to say, let's think about it as a small campfire that me and Keith could keep us warm, and that's life's experiences before January 6th. How would you describe what happened on January 6th as it relates to that campfire?
Well, that would be like throwing gasoline on top of the fire, right? So you have a campfire that's there, maybe the campfire is under control, then someone comes along and they throw, you know, gasoline on it, and gasoline just splashes everywhere. So now you have the fire that is spread and burning in areas that it didn't burn before. So not only is the flame itself more intense, it becomes out of control. It starts to burn areas that were not burnt before. And it makes more difficult for that individual who is experiencing that gasoline douse to, you know, get those feelings under control.
In your evaluations of Ms. Swerner, did she report to you any feelings of feeling like life was out of control?
Yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, that was one of the things for her that really increased her depressive symptoms, right? The idea that there was uncertainty now in her life. She doesn't know where her life is going. And, you know, there are times when we talk about the alterations in cognition, that would fall into that idea, right? The sort of what we call foreshortening of a person's future. Right, they don't know what's going to happen. Once upon a time, they could see. They could have ideas about what's going to happen. Now, they don't even trust their own thinking about what their future will hold because this traumatic experience has happened to them.
And when we talk about areas of the forest that are burnt, right, areas of their life that are burnt that weren't burnt before, can you talk to us about what those areas in your observation are in Ms. Warner's life now that before January 6, 2023, were untouched, unaffected?
Oh, yeah, sure. So right off, socially, she has lost the sense of being safe, something that she had not experienced before, even when she was feeling depressed or anxious. She was anxious about certain things. She was anxious about stress here or at work or in school or something like this. But she felt safe. She felt safe to go to events where other people were. She was felt safe to be around other people. She now doesn't want to go anywhere. She became socially withdrawn and isolative, pulled away from friends, didn't want to be in public as much, and felt fear in places that she didn't feel fear before, like the grocery store, feeling that she has to bring, family members or friends along with her, as support. The other piece was that her occupational functioning. This event had made her deal with such overwhelming distress about being in the classroom that she doesn't feel that she can go back to a classroom setting. She doesn't feel safe there, right? And one can imagine why, right? You're sitting in a classroom teaching, first graders. The last thing you expect is one of the first graders is going to pull out a gun and try to kill you. And so it makes sense that, especially when we go to the earlier criterion, that she would want to avoid such situations. Well, because she wants to avoid something that is so distressful, like the setting in which she was almost killed, then in her case, it requires her not to return to the classroom and lose her occupational functioning. She can't function in the way that she did once upon a time when she had depression before she could go to work, and she did go to work, and she was successful at it.
And when you talk about these alterations in mood and avoidance, if we heard that Ms. Werner went to a concert with family, are you saying that this means someone shouldn't go and shouldn't be able to go at all? Or is it just that when they go, something happens to them?
Sure. So what that means is that there will be times where a person might be able to do something, but they're experiencing something that they would not have experienced before, right? So number one, if she has to go with family and friends for support, that's something that she didn't feel like she needed before. She needed that support. She is not going back to a concert in the way that she once upon a time went to a concert. Now she is experiencing symptoms related to hyper arousal, where you become more hyper vigilant. You're feeling as if you are in danger, always looking, always watching, always scanning whether or not an individual near you might cause some harm. Why is this person looking different than the rest? Now you're keying in on one person in the crowd and watching that person instead of enjoying the concert. You're wondering whether or not this person is doing a little bit too much. Now I'm distracted thinking more about these negative things than enjoying whoever it is that I've come to see. So, depending on where a person is in treatment, that's a good thing. As a clinician, I want my patients to try. I want my patients to see if they can. I want them to try to get better, to see and test the bounds, because that means they want to get back to their lives. They don't want to just sit home and sit in their symptoms and cut their lives off. When I met with Ms. Werner, it was very clear to me that she wanted to get to a place of normalcy again, where she can go to concerts and such. So the only way to be able to see how she's able to do that is to be able to, have these experiences to try.
And in your review and evaluation of Ms. Werner, these two criterion that we've identified as C2 and D, were those met?
Yes.
My understanding of duration is that it's maybe not a whole different thing, but it talks about how long these different symptoms are going on. Is that fair?
That's correct, yes.
So tell us about how duration appeared in your evaluation of Ms. Werner.
Yes. So in order to meet the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, the symptoms, the other criteria that we talked about, have to be present for at least a month. Now, this is actually a very important point now that I think about it, is that within days of her the event of her shooting, She was seen by psychiatry in Riverside Regional Medical Center through a psychiatric consultation within days. And that psychiatrist evaluated her and listed right away many of the symptoms that we're talking about here today. She was experiencing almost immediately. But the problem, it's not a problem, the proper diagnosis was reached at that point. And that proper diagnosis was acute stress disorder. Because if it's under 1 month, you cannot officially diagnose it as post-traumatic stress disorder. Even though all of the symptoms related to a post-traumatic stress reaction happens to be there, you have to be able to meet that the letter of the criterion E for duration. So she was already recognized as on her way to developing post-traumatic stress disorder at that early point. And because of that, that doctor and those records made recommendations for future treatment in PTSD because it was anticipated that she would in fact develop it.
And in your review of the records, has Mrs. Werner been diligent in trying to get help for what's happened?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I've been very impressed. She not only has been seeking and continue to seek treatment with her family physician, who she had been receiving treatment, I mean, he was a family physician for a very long time, so knew her when she was having her earlier depressive symptoms to now, and so continue with that. Also continue with, I want to say, the therapist are through Abundant Life Partners, I think is what it is, where she's seen two therapists there and has received treatment interventions, not only in medication management, but also in what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, a psychotherapy counseling intervention, and also in eye movement desensitization reprocessing treatment, right? These specifically designed to treat individuals with PTSD.
And I don't want to use the word despite, but even with those efforts that she has undergone in the last 2.5 years, when you saw her in July, had her symptoms or were her symptoms still persisting as it relates to post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes, they were still persisting, yes.
And was she still under medication management at that time?
Yes.
And do you recall what medication management she was under at that time?
I don't recall specifically. I do know that she was receiving a antidepressant medication and anti-anxiety medication, I'm forgetting which one, along with continuing her psychotherapy.
And when we, does that, I'll ask it this way, your review and what we've talked about so far, does that establish in your mind and in your opinion, the duration requirements for post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes, it does.
And then tell us what clinically significant distress or impairment refers to.
Yes, so the last piece there is important because if a person has all of these symptoms and they don't impact them in their functioning, then it is more difficult for you to say, okay, this is a person who's suffering from a disorder. A disorder requires that there is some impairment of normal functioning. And so the criterion F points to how a person might subjectively experience significant distress to the point that they're having difficulty in their own emotional states day to day. And that might also spill out into very clear objective loss of functioning in important areas in our life, like work, like socially, family, friends, academically, and such. So we look for an individual to have clinically significant impairment in those areas.
And when we talk about clinically significant impairment, sometimes folks think of being numb to experiences. Have you ever heard that phrase?
Yes.
And can you tell us whether that is something that Ms. Zwerner expressed to you and what significance that has clinically?
Yes. There are times where, as associated with PTSD, a person can experience psychological numbness during times when they should really feel something, right? So some folks would think that's counterintuitive, but actually it is a defense mechanism, in a sense, where a person's emotional state, where it has been riding high for so long because you feel like you're in danger, in order to try to control to some degree, you have to be able to feel numb as a protective mechanism, right? So that happens sometimes. Now, this experience causes some confusion for individuals who have it, right? They don't understand why they are feeling nothing right now in a particular situation. And then there are other times where they're feeling too much and they don't want to feel too much. They don't want to feel afraid. They want to be able to go to the grocery store and not to take someone with them, those sort of things. So it could be very confusing. This is why, psychotherapy becomes important, to help folks process this mental health disorder.
And as a clinician, when somebody's reporting, and we've talked about some different topics here, like being disassociated or feeling nothing, how does that appear from a clinician standpoint, and how does that differ potentially from what an average person may expect?
Sure. As a clinician, if I'm sitting with someone who is experiencing that, I'm looking for emotional flattening, right? I'm looking for the lack of expression, a lack of response, a disconnect as I'm speaking with an individual about something that might be, you would expect to elicit some sort of emotional response to, right? You can think of it as a person who has been abused for many, many years, and then they see a violent act, and then they don't even react, right? And the rest of us will say, hey, well, what's going on? We need to move. But that person who has been abused chronically, they don't react in the same way. They don't view violence in the same way. There's a numbing to things, and that's abnormal.
And we've talked about these clinically significant findings or distress and impairment. Where, if anywhere, within the PTSD evaluation does suicidal ideation come into the play? And was that involved in your evaluation of Ms. Warner?
Yes. So that would be, yes, there was a point where Ms. Warner experienced passive suicidal thoughts because of the stress that she was feeling on a daily basis. That happened after the January 6th situation, shooting. And she had not experienced that before, passive suicidal thoughts. And at least in the records, there's none of that in there until after. That falls in the criteria under negative alterations in mood and cognition.
And so when we evaluate F, was that met in your evaluation of Ms. Warner as well?
Yes.
I want to talk to you on our final sort of stop here about the future.
Yes.
Is there, and we talked a little bit about this in terms of duration and the persistence of her symptoms as of July of this year. Tell us, as we sit here 2.5 years after this incident, what that indicates to you for evaluation and what that means for her prognosis into the future.
Yes. I am concerned as a clinician because despite significant efforts in terms of treatment, the symptoms persist. As a clinician, I don't know where Ms. Warner would be without the treatment that she's receiving now, right? If you understand my point, is that if she was not receiving the treatment that she has received, she would not be in good shape.
And keep going.
One of the very important pieces about Ms. Werner's case is that she has everyday reminders, permanent physical scars, reminding her of that particular day. So it's not just that she has psychological scars that she's dealing with from the trauma. She has impairment in her normal functioning, right? She had injury to her hand that has changed the way that she uses her body, that has caused her to have multiple surgeries because she continues to have complications around that. She has physical scars that she sees and she will see into the future when she changes her clothing or something along these lines, right? If she's going to the beach, I would imagine, you know, she might be mindful or thinking about that. And then lasting, she has a still has a bullet fragment that she knows is in her body, right? That was not there before, right? So that's not going to go away. That's there now. That's something that was not there before. So now these physical, real physical scars and impairment and functioning, they're constant reminders. That's the first thing. The other piece is this, is that she's still having nightmares. So something that's important about nightmares is this. All of us, when we have difficult times with stress, anxiety, depression, some of us will try to escape, right? Escape to, you know what, I need to go to sleep. Hopefully tomorrow will be a better day. I can sleep this off. I don't have to think about it. Right? So some of us look to that as sort of a refuge away from emotional stress, emotional difficulties, and such, for some relief there. When a person continues to have nightmares, what that tells me is that that person continues to struggle with such difficulty consciously related to those that traumatic event, that they can't even escape during sleep, that their unconscious presses into their sleep and then influences their dreams, right? We don't have control of our dreams, you know, when we're sleeping. And so when you have a disturbance of sleep, when you have these distressing nightmares and you wake up and you have this physiological responses, well, then you don't get refuge. And so, you know, so I hope that with continued treatment, I hope with, you know, of course, with her, you know, continue, and it sounds like she's been, from what I could see in the records, very active in her treatment and trying to get to a better place. But yes, I'm concerned. I'm concerned about that.
And in your professional opinion, is this post-traumatic stress disorder a chronic condition that will last throughout her lifetime?
Yes. I mean, this is, you know, it's hard for folks to be able to understand who might not have gone through that particular traumatic experience, right? So all of us will be able to understand the loss of a parent, especially if we had a close relationship with our parents, how difficult that might be. But not all of us have had the experience of someone trying to kill us and then surviving that, right? And so it becomes a very unique situation for that individual. It's just a very significant traumatic experience.
It'll be with her as long as the fragment's with her.
Yes.
Doctor, are all the opinions that you've testified to today held within a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Cross-examination?
Hello, Dr. Watson. We meet again.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Just to be clear, you've told the jury you were hired by Ms. Werner's lawyers, correct?
That is correct.
And the sole purpose of your evaluation of Ms. Werner is in connection with her claimed damages in this lawsuit?
That's correct.
And you talked about being a clinician, correct?
Yes.
But you are not a clinician to Ms. Werner?
That's correct.
You're not providing mental health treatment to Ms. Werner?
No.
In fact, you don't have an outpatient practice doing providing mental health treatment to individuals in the community.
no outpatient practice at this point. I have in the past.
Understood. And here, in deriving your opinions, you rely primarily on what Ms. Werner was willing to tell you, correct?
No.
You are you talking about the records that you reviewed?
Yes.
But those would be her self-reports in the records, what she was willing to tell other providers.
No. So, for example, in the medical records, it shows that she was shot. It shows her physical damages. That wouldn't be her self-report, that she was shot.
Understood, understood, Dr. Watson. I'm talking about her narrative about her mental health damages. That would be self-report from Ms. Werner when you met with her, correct?
Oh, yes, yes.
And then when you're looking at her records from other providers, it's what her self-report to those providers is.
Self-report plus their observations.
And you did not, let me strike that. You told the jury you met with Mrs. Werner twice, right?
Yes.
One was in person.
Yes.
And that was October 14, 2024.
That's correct.
And then you did a Teams conference in July 16, 2024.
That's right.
And that's the total encounters you've had with Ms.
Total of 6 hours, yes.
Okay. 6 hours. You did not conduct any collateral interviews, correct?
No.
And
they were not
tell
necessary.
The jury what a collateral interview is.
The collateral information, interviews would be reaching out to family members, gathering additional information from them about history and about current symptoms and current functioning. But it wasn't necessary in this case.
Based on your opinion, wasn't necessary?
Based on practice, we have had ample medical records. I have medical records dating back from with our family physicians that track. I mean, as a matter of fact, it was great because I was able to really track through her medical records well years and years before this event, all the way up to her symptoms after. And so talking with the family really would have been adding expense that was not necessary in this case.
And you talk about reviewing the primary care records?
Yes.
But you didn't review her counseling records prior to January 8, 2023?
Yeah, no, those were not. It wasn't necessary for me to go backwards because those records that I saw after also referenced her early treatment. So the changes in diagnosis were clear because the clinicians in the at the Abundant Life talked about her previous condition and then talked about her change in diagnosis.
But you did not review the Abundant Life Partners record prior to January 8, 2023?
No.
You did not review?
I did not
and
see
those.
And there's
ample records prior to this event that are in the Abundant Life health records, correct?
Well, I don't know because I haven't seen those, but I saw all of her psychiatric treatment through her family practice well before that. So that would have covered that time period.
You're telling the jury that the primary care records would cover her treatment by her mental health providers?
Yes, because they provided mental health treatment to her through West Point family practice. She was receiving all her psychiatric medications through them. She was reporting all of her anxiety. All of that was discussed in there. There was narrative. There was information about her father and what happened with her father. It's all in the West Point family practice records.
From the perspective of the West Point family practice providers?
From the perspective of a psychiatrist that does this on a regular basis. All the information that I would need to reach a clinical diagnosis, I had all the information I needed from the clinical providers who were treating a specific symptoms. West Point had all that information. From my standpoint as a clinician, when I need to reach a diagnosis, I had all the information I needed there.
I understand that, Dr. Watson, but you did not review the mental health records from Abundant Life prior to January 8, 2023.
That's correct.
You did not conduct any psychological testing?
No, that wasn't necessary.
Okay. And you did not refer Ms. Werner for psychological testing, correct?
Again, not necessary. That's correct.
Did not look at any of her social media reports?
Social media.
Any social media postings or?
No, okay. Social media.
Did not interview our coworkers?
It depends on, I didn't interview them directly. I had access to depositions.
And you did not observe her functioning in the community?
No, personally, no.
Didn't interview any of her therapists or healthcare providers?
No, not necessary.
Did not interview family or friends who were familiar with her functioning in the community?
No.
Did not review any of her education and training records at the cosmetology school that she attended after the shooting?
I don't believe I had those in the records. I don't recall that.
Did you ever seek verification of her self-report about not using recreational drugs?
That was replete in the, there was plenty of information about that in her medical records throughout. All of it was consistent. Everything that she said to me was consistent in the medical records going way back until 2016.
But those were her self-reports.
Right, but there was no testing from any clinician, from the family practice, or anything that indicated that she has ever had any substance use problems, that there was any concern, that there was any need to treatment, that there was any urine drug or blood test related to it. That's just not in the records.
I understand that, but I'm asking you, did you seek verification about her self-report about whether she had used recreational drugs?
Seek verification other than the medical records?
Yes.
Do you mean, I don't know what you mean, verification.
Did you review any text messages?
Whose text messages?
Ms. Werner's text messages.
Text messages about whether or not she uses drugs?
Yes.
No, okay. I didn't.
And you told the jury about Ms. Werner having a dream about a student on the day of shooting other than the student who shot her, correct?
Yes.
Did you ever gather more details about that student to determine whether he was the student who on the day in question told her that JT had a gun?
I'm not following your question.
You talked about the student who she mentioned dreaming about on the day of the shooting other than JT.
Okay.
And I'm asking you, did you gather any additional details to determine whether he was the student who had told her earlier in the day that JT had a gun?
No.
And you never interviewed her boyfriend, even though they lived together?
That's correct.
And he came to your office in Pennsylvania the first time when you met her in person. You didn't interview him?
No.
Did you ever review the school security video in the moments immediately after the shooting?
No.
And you never reviewed, again, her any text messages or social media postings?
That's correct.
And you've not met with Ms. Werner in person since October 15, 2024?
That's correct.
And you've not reviewed any of her counseling records since June 10, 2025, is that correct?
Whatever is there in my report. So I think that was the last set before my last meeting with Ms. Werner.
And you addressed the tragic loss of her father, correct?
Yes.
And that was something that you said she had worked through?
Yes.
Okay, and that was... But you didn't review the Abundant Life Partners records prior to January 8, 2023, correct?
Objection asked and answered.
Do you have any response to that?
I'll can try to rephrase.
All right, so sustained.
You did not see in other records where she had been treated for PTSD symptoms related to her father's tragic death?
No, I didn't see anything like
didn't
that.
Didn't see that because no. You didn't review the Abundant Life records. And you talk about Ms. Werner being reluctant to be in the public or have a public presence, correct?
That's correct.
But did you review any of her media reports or media interviews that she's giving?
No.
And that would be a public presence. Would you agree? If someone's on the Today Show.
That she's appearing in public?
Public presence.
So I think that we might... I'm not sure what the circumstances were and what sort of measures were put in place for her to make that appearance.
Did Did you review the GoFundMe site created by her sister?
No.
And that putting the story out that way?
No.
That's all I have, Dr. Watson. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any redirect?
One clarifying. There's a question earlier from Ms. Douglas about meeting on Teams in July of 2024. That meeting actually took place July 2025.
That's correct. Thank you.
That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. All right. May he be excused?
He may be.
All right. You are released from your subpoena. Thank you for coming and testifying
thank
today.
You.
All right. Good time to take a short break.
I think so, Your Honor.
All right, and who's going to be your next witness?
It'll be Ms. Zwerner.
Okay. All right, we'll go ahead and take a 15-minute recess, and then we will call the next witness. All right.
More continuing coverage of the Abby Zwerner civil trial is coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
The holidays are here, and that means it's the most wonderful time of the year to save with Rakuten. Use Rakuten to stack cash back at your favorite stores on top of holiday sales. That's savings on savings. With Rakuten, you can get cash back on gifts for everyone on your list. From toys for the kids, to kitchen gear for the person who loves to cook, to electronics for everyone. You can even save on something for yourself. Just shop the stores you love, and cashback is automatically added to your account. And you can get paid with gift cards, PayPal, or check. Or eligible American Express card members can even choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cashback. It's truly a no-brainer. Join for free today and get a new member bonus after minimum qualifying purchases. Just go to Rakuten.com, download the app, or install the browser extension. That's Rakuten. Terms and conditions apply.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Think about the last time you had a cancel subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.